You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
All right, g'day world, it's Cam, it's the 31st of January 2006, Rich isn't with me today, although he might pop on, he said, and I'll try and add him to this conference if I can, but I got a bunch of other people on the line talking to me about technology law. Today the show is all about technology law. Now, joining me, I have Professor Brian Fitzgerald. Brian is the head of the law school at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. Welcome to the show, Professor Brian.
Hello, Cameron. Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks, mate. Is this your first podcast?
Mate, it is, yeah. So it's a very exciting moment.
Happy to break your podcast virginity, and I promise I'll be gentle.
Thank you very much.
Brian, why don't you introduce the other people on the call?
Okay, so we're also going to be joined today by Professor Mark Perry, who is an adjunct professor here at QUT and also a professor at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. So Mark will be the other person, and maybe we'll hear a bit later on from some other people, but at the moment it's just the two of us.
Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Cam.
Is this your first podcast, Mark? Mark, is this your first podcast?
Possibly.
Possibly. Okay. Not giving
too
much away.
I'm reluctant to say.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. Well, there's obviously some skeletons in the closet there that we'll have to dig out Oprah style as we go forwards. So let's get started talking about technology and law. You know, I guess speaking on behalf of a blogger and a podcaster and somebody who's been in the technology business, the internet business, for the last 10 or 12 years, somebody who's on the wrong side of Gen Y, but not by too much. I mean, it seems to me, and it's funny because I just had lunch today with an acquaintance of mine who was a senior executive at Telstra for 30 years and is now the CEO of a startup. And I was talking about the fact that it just seems like every other day somebody is suing somebody else for IP infringement. And he said to me, oh, didn't you know IP litigation is the new software business? And that he was talking about the company that he's now running. They've got a patent on a piece of software. To me, it sounds like something that shouldn't be patented, but it looks like they're getting away with it. And I said, so what are you going to do with all these other businesses that are already using a similar sort of solution? And he said, oh, great, we'll just sue them. They'll have to pay us, so we'll sue them. And I'm like, what is wrong with the world? So that's my first question to you guys. What is wrong with the world? What is going on?
Oh, that's a big question.
And can you answer that in 10 words or less? No.
Well, one of the big issues here is that you do have people who own intellectual property, whether that be copyright or patent rights, and you also have people having competing uses, whether they're users of the technology or they're consumers. And it's the law has to try and reconcile those interests. And the more extreme the law gets, I suppose, the more difficult it becomes for people to have confidence and respect in the law. So in recent times, we've seen lots of new technologies where the law has come down with some fairly interesting determinations, and people have said, well, is the law really up to date? You know, what do we need to do to improve things?
Well, let's talk about something that happened in Australia in the last few months, which I guess is probably going to be familiar to people who listen to this show. And this was the whole court case with the peer-to-peer software company.
Yeah, so the Kazaa software.
Kazaa! I'm so familiar with them, I can't even remember who it was. The Kazaa case. Now, what did you think of the outcome of the Kazaa case?
Well, there's been worldwide litigation for years over the downloading of music in MP3 format. We can go back to the Napster court case a few years back, and I suppose the Kazaa one has brought it home to Australia. And there are a lot of difficult issues to look at in the Kazaa case. I mean, I suppose at the bottom you've got copyright music that someone owns being downloaded and used, if you like, by end users. And someone's saying, well, hang on a minute, that's going to threaten our business model. And I suppose, Mark, if you want to come in here, you know, one of the unknowns here is just to what extent downloading music will actually hurt the recording industry and the copyright owners of music, and to what extent it actually might have the potential to prosper or improve the commercial revenue from music.
Yeah, I think one of the other problem, Cam and listeners, is that the software and the technology has developed really quickly before we've had the proper legal framework in place, and also before, you know, people have come to see what they're doing as being something that may not be moral, let alone legal. So before these sort of people standards have developed, or the social aspects have developed, the software has been available for people to do things that they couldn't do before, and so you get people taking advantage of it before there's a legal framework and before there's the social aspects in place as well.
But, you know, it's fairly hypocritical, though, isn't it, really? Because if we look at let's look at the music business for a start. I mean, we all know that nothing is new under the sun, and a lot of the tracks that are owned by the big record labels have been made off not only of the off the backs of the artists who recorded that actual tune, but every tune has been built on top of blues riffs and jazz riffs and folk tunes that were available, you know, that were around 100 years ago, 200 years ago. This rock and roll was built on blues, and blues was built on folk tunes, and, you know, the riffs, the scales, none of that is new and original. It's all been stolen and ripped off and adapted by somebody else over the last 100 years. When did we suddenly decide this kind of stuff was copyrightable? And how long do you think they're going to be able to justify that model? It seems to me that it's already breaking down under the weight of its own insolence.
Well, you know, the whole, I suppose you lead us really into a whole thing that's happening at the moment, and it has happened forever, really, with culture, is that people, you know, draw upon the past to create the future. And this whole idea that we call today remix, and how the copyright law or any other type of intellectual property law can actually facilitate that or allow it to happen. I think it's fair to say that our current copyright laws make it difficult for us to take recorded music, for instance, that's owned by someone and reutilize it, even in a way that perhaps doesn't compete with the market that the original owner might anticipate. So recently we saw that someone had done a remix version of a Green Day CD called American Idiot, and in that case I think the remix was called American Edit, and the person that had put it up on a website was asked to take it down. Now, I suppose there's a lot of interesting questions that come out of that, whether you think that's good or bad. Was the person out there making money? Was that actually appreciated by people out there in entertainment land? Is it something that we should be encouraging within our culture, or is it something we should be stopping? So the whole idea of how long we've had copyright, what value does copyright play in our society, is very much challenged, as you suggest, Cameron, by this current sort of networked environment. But you know, intellectual property has been pretty strong in the legal system, particularly you know, in Australia. You know, for the last 100 years or longer, we've had a fairly definite sort of legal position on copyright.
I don't know, Cam, whether you know this quote from Isaac Newton. If I've seen so far, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And he was really referring to the ability, not only in creative things like music and literature, but also in science, the ability to move forward is very much built on what's gone before. And it's a difficult balancing act for intellectual property regimes to be able to, on the one hand, support that ability to use what has gone before, but at the same time cut off economic rights for people who do develop new materials so that they can, you know, make a living.
Well, I'm sure you guys are familiar with Creative Commons, and there is so much material being produced now and licensed under a Creative Commons fair attribution license, or one of those CC licenses, that really seems to be a massive trend at the moment. I recently read a book by Cory Doctorow that I know Corey had, a sci-fi book that he had licensed under Creative Commons, and it has since been made available as an e-book. Somebody has podcasted by, you know, reading the novel. And there's an immense amount of innovation happening on top of that IP that he wrote. We've got bands releasing music under Creative Commons. All of the podcasts that we have on TPN, except for a select handful, are licensed under Creative Commons. So do you see that Creative Commons is sort of rising in a public sense to be the replacement of the copyright that we're more familiar with from the 20th century?
Sorry. I think Creative Commons certainly opens our minds up to new ways of managing copyright. I don't think it necessarily will ever become the only way we license copyright, but it certainly challenges us to think about how we manage it, particularly in the digital world. QUT has been involved, and myself have been involved with the Australian Creative Commons project, and there are now recorded 53 million link backs to the Creative Commons licenses worldwide, which is that's an enormous statistic, and something that probably wouldn't have been imagined when the project started only a few years back. There are still some limitations on the project, though. One of them you mentioned in terms of musicians. People who are members of certain collecting societies and performing rights societies have to check what their membership rights are, and also have to check with those societies whether they're actually able to utilise Creative Commons licences, and in some cases they will require permission of the particular organisation. But particularly in the text and other sort of digital media fields, we've seen enormous amounts of material being shared lawfully under Creative Commons licences. But you need some prerequisites. You need to have a person who owns copyright in the core material, and they need to have the ability to actually share that with others. And then they select certain conditions upon which they want to share. So it may be you can share my content so long as you attribute or say it's mine. You can use it so long as you use it non-commercially. You can use it so long as you don't make derivatives. You can use it so long as you share back to me any improvements that you make upon it. So they're the core protocols, if you like, of the Creative Commons license, and that is usually badged or labelled on a piece of material that you'll find on the net, and that will explain what user rights you have that the copyright owner has permitted you to exercise. And that's new, because the traditional copyright model is, if I find something on the internet and there's no clear message as to how I can use it, unless there's some statutory or some exception in the statute law, I have to ring up and get permission. What Creative Commons licenses do is give permission in advance, and they increase negotiability in the online world. Now, Creative Commons licenses at the moment only cover a very small segment of the total World Wide Web, but that will increase. It won't. I don't think it'll ever become all, everything, but it certainly will increase. And I think that's what you're saying, Cameron. It's an insight as to what people might be able to do. And Cory Doctorow is a classic example.
I get the sense that if we look at what's been happening in the internet world, in terms of some of the activities of some of the bigger web-driven businesses in the last few years, we may get an insight into where content IP is going as well. If you look at eBay, Amazon, Google, Flickr, Delicious, and a lot of these top internet-based properties, in the last couple of years, what a lot of people refer to as the Web 2.0 phase of this whole thing that we've been doing on the internet, you've seen a lot of these businesses start to decouple their back-end systems and provide a set of their functionality as an exposed web service, or they expose the APIs, as the software developers will say. And so, and making it freely available for people to access. So, they will say, well, we've got this engine on the back end that understands a lot about books or understands a lot about auctions or whatever it is. You then, global development community, can go out and build new and exciting and fantastic services that just plug in and take advantage of all of this work that we've done. And good luck to you. And it's been hugely successful. There's been all of these new innovations and services that have been built on top of and are adding value to those engines. And, you know, the business model, as I understand it, on behalf of the Amazons and the eBays and the Googles, is that the more services that are built on top of their service, sort of the more embedded their service becomes, the more popularity it has, the more lock-in it has. And I can kind of see that happening around the content services as well. You know, I know from a podcast network perspective, you know, we've always licensed our stuff under fair attribution with CC. And people say to me, well, what if somebody takes your stuff and reuses it? I'm like, well, fantastic. As long as they attribute it back to us, it's yep. marketing, it's promotion. And but what if they make money off of it? And I'm like, well, good on them. You know, if they make more money out of my content than I do, it means that they're better business people or better marketers or they're smarter than it.
Yes.
So it seems to be changing, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of businesses that will continue to resist that, obviously, but there's a lot more. And I guess it's being led by the open software movement that are trying to, have been trying to drive this thing for the last 10 or 15 years as well.
Look, I'll just make a couple of brief comments and I might hand over to Mark, because Mark is a holds a joint appointment as a professor in IT and a professor in law. But I think one of the things that you see is whether people progress a model of business that's sort of a property model or a service model. And the idea with the property model is that it's all about protecting your property rights, and the service model is probably more about people utilising your services and marketing yourself. And I think that attribution license in the Creative Commons suite of conditions is something that people have utilised to say, hey, look, go away and share this, utilise it, just let people know that it's mine, because that's the value I want to, you know, I would really like to get out of this. And it's quite a powerful way of marketing yourself in this networked environment. So, Mark, I'm not sure if you want to talk a little bit more specifically about what Cameron was raising about the content revolution.
Well, certainly in the software realm, there's been a huge change in some of the companies. Of course, others have kept the proprietary model for their software distribution. In fact, I was just looking through Wired News this morning and saw that someone had been jailed for not leaking, but on selling the source code to the Windows operating system in 2004. So, you know, some businesses certainly have held tightly onto their proprietary secret code models, but other businesses like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Sun have made very good money out of moving over to an open source model for their software side of their business, at least in some parts of it. So there is a movement there to shift and take on board new types of business models that can make best use of it.
Cameron, can I just also mention, it looks like we've been joined by another person, Scott Keel Chisholm, and Scott's the project manager of our Oak Law project, which is the Open Access to Knowledge Law project that we're actually running here at QUT. So I'm not sure, Scott, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Cameron, can you hear me?
Yeah, g'day, Scott, how are you going, mate?
Not too bad, thank you. Yourself?
Pretty good, mate. So tell us a little bit more about Oak Law, Scott. What's that all about?
Terrific. Well, open access to knowledge is really something that is being fueled by the open access movement, and we're seeing that especially tertiary institutions are either desiring to put research material and PhD theses into digital form, into the digital repositories, and provide access to that material, so that other researchers can build on what's been developed by the students here, in whatever institution has the repository. Now, like Brian was saying, and with Creative Commons, they've started to look at the copyright issues that arise in relation to having those pieces of work in the repositories. And so our goal with the project is to look at the issues, the copyright issues that are involved, and look at developing protocols to help manage those issues. At the same time, too, we're going to be looking at investigating the provision of rights expression language that will help to implement those protocols at a technical level. So Brian is the leader of the project, and it's funded by the Department of Education, Science and Training. So we have a couple of years to look at numbers of issues, including the copyright issues in PhDs, which can be quite complicated when, say, the PhD is in the area of science, where there are numbers of different pieces of information included in the thesis that somebody else may own copyright in. So, for instance, say a photograph or a diagram, where the author is not necessarily the owner of that photograph or diagram. So once it's in digital form, there possibly needs to be consent by those other copyright holders before anybody in the world can access that. So that's just one of the issues. We'll be looking at a number of other issues as well, including jurisdiction is always a bit of a wrestle, because with the internet, obviously anybody can access it throughout the world. But if you have you provide a license for the use of the work out of the repository, where then can you enforce the license? Does it need to be here in Australia? Can it be in Africa or America? So that's just another issue that we'll be dealing with. So it's quite a complex and interesting project that we hope will provide results to enable repositories in the different institutions, possibly also in government, to be able to provide freer access to the information, to knowledge, and to help build societies some understandings of numbers of issues.
Scott, have you got funding to figure out a way to turn that into English that I can understand?
I'm sorry.
God, man, you academics can talk. I didn't understand a word of what you just said, Scott. I'm hoping somebody out there in the audience understood that, because I have no fracking idea what you were talking about.
But, my humble apologies.
No, it's not you, mate. It's me. I'm just not smart enough to understand all these
No, that's terms. Not the case.
Just think, Oak, open access to knowledge, and that's what we're trying to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, mm-hmm. I thought we already had that. I thought that's what the internet was about. But okay, obviously not enough. We need more. So let me ask you guys some questions. I have heard that it's said that if I take a CD that I buy in a store, pay good money for it, take it home, rip it and put it on my iPod, I'm breaking the law in Australia. Is that still true?
Yes.
Yeah, it hasn't been tested before the courts, but most of us say, look, that is a real risk, and the Commonwealth Attorney General currently undertaking a review of what we call our fair dealing provisions, and it's hoped, I suppose, that situation might be remedied in the near future.
See, why is it so hard? It's sit me down with the Attorney General for 5 minutes, and I'll have him going, yeah, you're right, that's stupid, let me just cross that one out and sign it off. I mean, come on, this isn't hard stuff, guys. This is common sense. Yeah, that's ridiculous. You paid it, you own it, you do whatever the hell you want with it. And my second question, if you go to the cinema in this country, you get a DVD out, you see these stupid bloody ads at the moment going, you wouldn't steal a car, you wouldn't steal a movie, downloading is theft. And I'm going, well, hold on a minute. If I buy a book and I read the book, and I give it to my next door neighbour and say, hey, you'll really enjoy this book, you should read it. Is he stealing? No, he's loaning it. I'm giving him a read. Now, he's not going to keep it necessarily.
Just to play the devil's advocate here. So, of course, with the book, there's only the one book.
Well, not necessarily. What if he gets a pen and writes it out longhand? Is he breaking the law?
Yeah, but he's not going to do that, is he?
Ah, you don't know that. What if he does?
But
is he breaking the law?
With Well, I suppose he would be, yeah. But the point is, the digital context does change, the environment that people are working. It is something different. Even if you give your CD and he rips his CD, he can then distribute hundreds of thousands of copies of that CD at almost zero transaction cost, at almost zero cost.
Yeah, but
you couldn't do that with a book.
Well,
you just couldn't do it.
Can I add in a bit? I suppose the that's a classic example. I can read a book. Someone can give me a book, and I can read it. And I'm not breaching any copyright rights. But in the digital environment, everything that you do, every which way you look, is technically a reproduction in using the technology. So right at the very start of the process, the copyright owners, I suppose, have an advantage. But one of the things about the films, as with the music, is that it's all right for copyright owners to say, we've got great rights of ownership over vast categories of entertainment, and we respect that to some extent. But there's also an obligation on some of these large businesses to look at new business models where people can actually access material conveniently and in a seamless manner, and maybe paying some sort of fee for it. But
they're
at the
not
moment.
Do that.
Well, hang on.
They're not going to do it until they're forced to do it, either by legislative means or marketplace pressure.
Okay, so what
was they've got the world good. They don't want change. They like it as it is.
Oh, hang on. There's a couple of responses. One is just there's a guy in the US called Fred Von Lohman who writes a lot about. He calls himself a DRM skeptic, and he says that it's no use copyright owners putting all their material out under lots of technological protection measures, because people will hack through it overnight and they'll get access to it. He says, though, if you come up with a good business model, maybe Apple iTunes, people might actually sign up and utilize it because it's convenient. They've got a guarantee that they're not going to get sued, and they find some comfort in doing that. So there are some business models out there that people will latch onto. And another person, Professor Terry Fisher at Harvard, has said, look, why don't we just add a few dollars to everyone's ISP account each month and allow people to download whatever they want, and collect that money and redistribute it to the copyright owners, and maybe they'll be happy, maybe they won't be happy, but there are some other models that we could be thinking about, perhaps.
But here's what's happening, and this is from my perspective, a new media content person, is by the end of this decade there are going to be hundreds of thousands or even perhaps millions of easily obtainable, freely available, and legal audio and video songs and programs and movies for me to consume. I'll easily be able to spend every spare minute of my day watching and listening to high-quality product that is licensed under some sort of sane, rational Creative Commons license. And what's going to happen is that the traditional industry, are either going to have to get their shit together and get with the program, or just find themselves on the outside of what's happening. And I don't think it's going to require any special sort of legislative power or anything. It's just starting to happen. It's already the point where if you want to, you can pretty much get every piece of software you need from some sort of an open source solution. And it's starting to get to the point where you can pretty much find an audio show on any subject that you want as a freely available podcast. Give us another 5 years of Moore's Law and increased broadband, and you'll pretty much be able to get a TV show or a movie produced by people and freely distributed. So I keep hoping that Congress or the Senate or whoever in the US will pass a bloody broadcast flag law and, start to introduce some draconian measure for enforcing DRM onto every device that's produced. Because it's just going to be an additional nail in their own goddamn coffin. I mean, there's all this free stuff that the producers want to be free because we have alternative economic models. I think it'll be fantastic if they DRM themselves out of existence. What do you say about that?
Oh, it sounds exciting, but I'm sure there's lots of people who play devil's advocate with you as well and say, look, the creative industries, they need sustainable revenue models, and Australia has a small creative industries. Are we using foreign content? So there's a whole issue about how do we fund our creators, or even the people who commercialise for creators. And as you say, well, models are changing and there are alternatives, and we've certainly been involved in that with the Creative Commons, and we're hopeful about that. But there are some limitations, I suppose, in the current model. Down the track, maybe the model that you and the picture that you're painting is one that we will see. I don't know, Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, do you still watch TV, Cam?
Very rarely.
You watch the news or something? Or,
no, God no. We have no news in this country. It's all manufactured by big corporations to push their own selfish corporate agenda.
But that's worth watching, just to see what it is.
I mean, I do watch television, but it usually comes in the package of on some form of digital distribution mechanism. time shifted. But yes, I do. Yeah. And so, some of these US shows have massive budgets.
Yeah. So, they make, some quite cool stuff sometimes.
Yeah, but I go and pay my $50-$60 for, Sopranos Series 5 or West Wing Series whatever. Mm. And they do make cool stuff. I'm not saying all TV is bad or all movies is bad. But what I'm saying is that unless the companies that own the copyright for those or are producing those start to get their shit together, there is an increasing amount of good quality video being produced and distributed over the web. And the economics of the content business has changed dramatically in the last decade, hasn't it? I mean, the cost of production now is dropping exponentially every year thanks to technology. The cost of distribution has reached, close to zero because of technology and broadband. The cost of marketing is still a bit of a challenge. How do you get people to find out that you have this content?
Yeah.
But we're finding new mechanisms like podcasting that we have a couple of music shows on TPN that have thousands and thousands of listeners tuning every week to get the best indie music that our hosts can produce. Now, I'm quite confident that a couple of years from now we'll have millions of people tuning into those shows to discover the latest indie music, and then we'll connect them directly up with those artists and their websites where they can purchase music or iTunes or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things you raise in that is that this certainly has been documented in the sort of the creativity literature that, we've also seen an emergence of a new class of creativities and creators. They might be people who work in day jobs and go home at night and thump around on the computer, and they can distribute it immediately by putting it up on a website to maybe a sort of a cold audience, or they might be able to contact you and have it podcast or whatever. So there's a whole dimension too of this idea that people call the pro-am revolution in creativity that has really, I suppose, sparked many new ideas about what might be possible.
But it's not just the amateurs banging around and not knowing what they're doing. Are you guys familiar with the Star Wars film that came out just before Revenge of the Sith?
Oh, yeah, we not. I don't know a lot about it, but I'm sure Mark and Scott do.
Yeah, I did see that.
Yep.
Keep going, Cameron.
Basically, there was a Star Wars fan film that came out and was distributed over the net.
That was very funny.
Just a month or two before Revenge of the Sith came out. It was called Star Wars Revelations. Now, this was produced by a company called Panic Struck Productions, and Panic Struck is basically made up of guys out of Hollywood. These are Star Wars geeks that work in Hollywood as special effects guys or whatever it is in their day jobs, who wanted to produce a Star Wars fan film. And they did, over the course of like a year in their spare time with their own money and their own equipment, they produced a Star Wars fan film. It was about an hour long, and the special effects were astounding. The script and the acting were equally as bad as any real Star Wars film, so there wasn't much to difference. But the special effects were jaw-dropping how good they were. And these guys and girls were producing this at home on their Mac G5s or whatever it was. Now, and one of the things I've seen in podcasting increasingly in the last year is I get people every day of the week now sending me emails saying, look, I've got a radio background and, I'm sick of the creative limitations that mainstream radio offers and I want to do my own thing, I'm increasingly confident that over the course of the next 5 years, we'll see the same thing in people who work in the television and film industries that are trained, that are skilled, but are frustrated with the creative and business limitations that the current way of doing things allows them, will start producing really, really cool shit just because they can and they want to, and make it available freely over the web so they get kudos, so they get street cred, to build their profile. The same reason why a lot of people do podcasts today, it's to build their public profile, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean...
still there? Tap, tap.
Yeah,
I think... microphone on. Hello.
Yeah, mate, you're still there.
End Cameron rant. Sorry, guys. Yeah. I know I'm supposed to be interviewing you here, but I get carried away sometimes.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think if you're a filmmaker and you said, how could I get to the broadest possible audience? Well, I suppose in today's world, you'd think about something like podcasting. You know, how can I get my material out there somewhere that everyone can access it? I mean, as a creator, isn't that ultimately what the creator really wants to do? They want people to access their creativity. So, I mean, what you're saying is, I suppose, to some extent, meeting that sort of desire. Older models are much more controlled and perhaps much more difficult to negotiate. So people are saying, well, what about new models? I don't know firsthand the Star Wars version movie that you're talking about, but yeah, I have heard of that happening. So people who are skilled going home at night and producing things and putting it out through an alternative distribution medium, and that seems to work. I don't know, Scott, Mark, what of this?
Well, it makes me think of what Professor Lessig was saying from Stanford University, was saying about the culture changing. Yeah. The whole idea of remix is becoming part of our form of communication. So people, they develop a work of art, they distribute it on the internet, and expect that people will want to take that work and add to it and create their own piece of work. So this whole cultural kind of revolution, in a way, is kind of developing, and the internet is making it possible. Mm. The difficulty that I think we always seem to run into, and you know, I think is going to continue until we develop the sort of protocols that are necessary, is that there are legal constraints, and this is where the copyright aspect comes back in, because people need to know what they can do to the work that's released, and if they don't know, then they stand the chance of infringing copyright law, and that could then end up inhibiting the freedom to reuse, to recreate those works of art. I'm not sure if that's the kind of direction you were talking about, Cameron, with that whole idea with the Pro-Am group wanting to release the items that they've created, and having the technology to be able to do that, but then wanting to know that they can freely take and reuse the information that is there on the net.
Yeah, it reminds me, there's also Star Trek New Voyages. I don't know if you've seen that one, Cam. a new original Star Trek version has popped up.
I hadn't heard of that.
The problem remains the same, and it's not that there's not enough content. The problem is finding the good stuff.
Well, yeah, and, you know, there are lots of models starting to emerge for helping us to do that. But it's, you know, we're seeing the success of social networking technologies online building to a point where there's a massive word of mouth infrastructure developing. So whether you go to a destination site like TPN, where we only have good stuff, or you, hey. Did I hear somebody laugh?
No, that's right. No, you're exactly right, Cameron. Not laughing. just affirming what you're saying.
Oh, okay. I was going to have to come down the line and smack you around if you're laughing. you look at some sort of a ratings-based system, or you're reading, your favourite half a dozen blogs, and you're listening to what they're saying their favourite shows are that they're listening to. It's instant messenger. There's a lot of different grassroots, bottom-up mechanisms for... promoting this through social networking. I see moving forward is going to be less and less of the Britney Spears and U2s that make squillions of dollars a year out of the music business while the rest of the artists struggle in obscurity. And perhaps more of an evening up of the revenue opportunities as more and more people get equivalent levels of exposure via word of mouth networks, and the revenue gets spread around in a similar fashion. Anyway, guys, final points. Professor Mark.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful world. Stuff's changing all the time, and you have to keep on your toes to see what's going on. I think that's what it is.
Now, tell me the URL of your blog and podcast where people can keep up to date with your views on the matter, Professor Mark.
you can see my webpage if you like. As you know, podcasting takes a lot of time, so I just don't get time to do that. But if you go to my webpage, you can read lots of marvellous articles.
So does eating, Mark. Do you manage to fit that in?
Sometimes no.
Okay. We'll put your URL on the page. Scott.
Okay, www.halfsunday.com.
Yeah, you'll put it up on the page. I've got it here. Scott, final thoughts.
Yes, well, we've got a URL as well for the Oak Law Project. It isn't quite online, but hopefully will be before the end of the week. It's www.oaklaw.qut.edu.au.
Is it written in English or academic?
it is in English, and hopefully it's relatively easy for people to understand, but we also have an email address there that people who have questions or concerns or would like further information are by all means encouraged to send us an email, and we'll get back to them, no problems at all.
Thank you, Scott. Who's saying shit in the background there?
Oh, it wouldn't be us. That's interference somewhere down the line.
Oh, right. Got to cross line. Now, Professor Brian, final thoughts for the audience on the state of technology law.
Okay, Cameron, well, just there are so many things, so many cases, so many reviews happening in Australia, particularly over the last 12 months. We've had the Sony PlayStation case, we've had the Kazaa case, we've had the panel case where snippets were taken from Channel 9 and played on the television program The Panel on Channel 10. We've had a fair use review, we've had the implementation of the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement, Technological Protection Measures Inquiry, we've had the Crown Copyright Review. We've got all these things happening, and all of them have a great impact on the digital environment. I suppose one of the things that I'm working on at the moment, and one of the ones that I'd really like people to think a little bit more about, is to what extent do people have roles, responsibilities and obligations in the digital environment to respect the environment and its communication aspect, just like we ask people, particularly landowners, in the real world, in the physical environment, to protect our natural environment. So 50 years ago we started to ask people not to pollute streams and not to cut down trees and so on. When will we get to the point where we actually ask our big property owners in the digital environment to also take on a sense of respect and responsibility for the innovation in the communication networks that are developing? And I think that's the real challenge for the law as well as for business and more broadly for culture.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for joining me, guys. I think you'll have to come on and do more of this. I can sense a podcast in the works here.
Sounds good.
Very exciting, mate. Very exciting.
A regular update on technology law. Professor Brian, Professor Mark, Scott, thank you very much for joining me today on G'day World.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cameron.
Nice talking to you, Cam.
Bye. Bye.
Interesting stories about travel-related people, products, places, and ideas. The TPN Travel Show, travel.thepodcastnetwork.com. Take the first step on your next travel experience.
The Podcast Network. Real power can't be given.
It must be taken.